You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Jack.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm not going to complain right now. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. You're Jack Goldsmith. You're exactly the person I want to talk to you right now. That's why I emailed you a couple of weeks ago, because I want you to tell us how worried we should or shouldn't be about Donald Trump. Some people after his first month or so in office are worried that his, exercise in consolidation or attempts to consolidate presidential power and arguably expand it are worrisome and could spell, according to some people, the end of democracy by the end of his term. And you're very well positioned to address these things because, for one thing, you've written about the subject of presidential power. You wrote a book called Power and Constraint. You're a professor at Harvard Law School. You served in the George W. Bush Justice Department and were involved in consequential and, in some cases, controversial advisory opinions about what that particular president could and couldn't authorize. And also, you are now doing a Substack newsletter called Executive Functions in collaboration with Bob Bauer, and you are covering a lot of this stuff there. Now, since we set up this conversation, you wrote an op-ed for The Economist. This is one of these invited things where I guess you should feel very honored. They approached you, I gather, like...
They
have this thing once a week. This person's so important that we approach them to opine on this. You were that week's, a week ago, you were that person. And the very title of the piece answered some of my questions about whether we
I didn't write the title. I wrote the body of it. They wrote the title.
Well, if you want, I'll read the title. If you want to complain about it, this is your chance. The title is Donald Trump is Taking Presidential Power to Alarming Places. Is that?
That's not the title I would have given it.
Is it an inaccurate title?
I don't alarming and worrisome. I don't know. I mean, clearly there's stuff going on here that we should be worried about, whether it's alarming. Yeah. It's very hard for me to sort out at this point. It's very early on. The courts have barely gotten involved. The public has barely gotten involved. If it's going to get involved. They've been extremely unprecedentedly, in some ways, very cleverly and ruthlessly aggressive in trying to change the reality on the ground in the executive branch. That's for sure.
Yeah. Now, there are kind of two issues, it seems to me, that it's good to separate. Both would be cause for concern. One is when cases where the president seems to be clearly breaking the law or arguably breaking the law. And the other is cases where he may not be breaking the law, but he's departing from longstanding norms that play an important role in our government and in preserving the balance of powers. And I thought maybe we could start with one of the most recent things that has alarmed some people, and which you wrote about maybe even today in your newsletter, Executive Functions. But I see there's a piece about it there. And that's this stuff at the Pentagon. So he fired the chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, fired, I guess, the military heads of all the service branches, the flag officers, either all or three or four, and either did replace or announced plans to replace the top lawyers in each branch. The judge adjutant general is the term, I gather. They are the top JAG officers kind of in each service branch. I should say this, I find there are two separate reasons to worry about that. One is that, if there are protests and counter protests and there's violence and Trump says he needs to mobilize the military and bring them in, I assume these lawyers might facilitate that in some way. But then there's separately, I mean, you tell me if I'm wrong, but there's separately the fact that Pete Hegseth is famous for defending war criminals. And it seems pretty clear that the replacements for these JAG officers would give soldiers a freer rein on the battlefield.
Yeah, that's what he's pretty clearly trying to do. He's complained about military lawyers. He actually said yesterday on Fox News, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but he kind of let it slip. One of those Michael Kinsley slips that told the truth, where he said basically that, I'm paraphrasing, but we wanted them to not be a roadblock to doing what we want to do.
That's what Trump said.
No, that's what Hegseth said.
Hegseth said, okay.
Something to that effect yesterday, yeah.
And do you think he had in mind the behavior on the battlefield as opposed to the first thing I mentioned, which is Trump maybe using the military on the domestic scene?
I don't know what he had in mind. I think he clearly, I have not studied what he said about this a lot. I think he does think that the military's been too restrained on the battlefield. I think he thinks that the warfighting rules that are over and above on top of what the legal constraints are, and they're sometimes even more demanding. And especially during the COIN operation period, there was very severe rules of engagement. I think he thinks that clearing away the lawyers or getting lawyers who are going to be more accommodating is important to returning what he thinks is the warfighting ethos of the department. There's a strong counter argument that it depends on the lawyer, but legal constraint helps to instill discipline, which is hugely important on the battlefield, obviously, not to mention making sure you comply with the law.
Yeah, and I promise not to exercise my antipathy toward Pete Hegseth unduly. This is the last thing I'll say, but, in terms of the military being more effective, if it's a little less constrained, I mean, one of the people he is famous for defending and getting Trump during his first term to lighten the penalty toward or something is this guy Eddie Gallagher, who, according to testimony from his fellow Navy SEALs, right, as I remember it, like they had a POW who was being treated by a medic, and Gallagher just walked over and stabbed him with a knife, and the guy died. That's the guy Hegseth was defending, but I will leave it at that.
Yeah.
So in that particular case, this case of Trump firing or Trump replacing these lawyers, I gather that's an opportunity to distinguish between violating the law and violating norms. He has the right to do that, right?
Yeah.
Legally.
And let's go further. The president has their civilian control of the military. So, yes, the president has the authority to do this. Although I think it was the SecDef who did the firing. I'm not sure. So, yes. I mean, whether this is a norm violation, I don't know. It's certainly a norm. I just don't know whether there's a norm of not replacing JAGs until their term ends, that there's some kind of restraint on that. I don't know. But look, can I say something? This is part of this is one slice of a much larger effort across the administration to basically do two related things. Get rid of all lawyers who are seen as problems of getting in the way of what the administration wants to accomplish, and replacing the three parts. Second, replacing them to the greatest extent possible with absolute loyalists who have a view that the president's policy should be upheld. And then three, all the lawyers you can't get rid of and who you don't know to be loyalists, you want to scare the hell out of them with directives and threats to make sure they stay in line. So the JAG thing is just the latest of a kind of administration-wide effort to bring the lawyers under control. And they've said, the Trump people have said, the lawyers got in the way in the first term and we don't want them to get in the way this term. That they've been very explicit about this.
So what other categories of lawyers are being replaced? There are U.S. attorneys. Those are the chief prosecutors in the federal system. And I guess, I don't know, has he replaced more of those than usual? There have been other presidents who right away replaced some U.S. attorneys, right?
Yeah, he fired all the U.S. attorneys, and that's not unusual. He fired all the U.S. attorneys. But what he's been doing on the firing front, I actually think that the hiring front is more significant. But on the firing front, he's basically been going through, and I would say 90% of the people that they've canned or moved around are people who worked on cases against him. So that's a little kind of retaliation, retribution, and that's consistent with some of their directives that say you have to be loyal to the president, and if you've been disloyal in the past, you can't be loyal now. I think there have been several dozen of those that have been fired or reassigned. The real news is that the entire Justice Department, the top people there now, and most of the ones who are nominated are his former, basically criminal defense or related attorneys, which is quite extraordinary, and who've worked for him as private attorneys for a very long time. And they appear to have the view that the president gets to determine what the law is, and we have marching orders to carry that out, and we don't intervene with any, as is normally the case, with our views about what the law are and whether you should be doing this, Mr. President.
Mm-hmm. Now, has he clearly defied any court orders so far?
In my judgment, he has not. They have, I just looked at this, and they've been playing a game of cat and mouse about compliance. This is not unheard of. They've been interpreting the directives to insert and very narrowly to let them keep doing what they want to do. They say, well, okay, you said we couldn't do it based on this legal authority, but we're using a different legal authority. These are not atypical cat and mouse examples. They've been going on, it seems to me, a little more aggressively and extensively than usual, and it seems to be a concerted policy. I would not say there have been press reporting to the contrary, but I have not seen a clear case of defiance yet.
Mm-hmm. And I think they are on record as saying they would ultimately obey the Supreme Court, although J.D. Vance tweeted something that people took to mean the opposite of that. I'm not sure about that. But hasn't the White House said, yes, Trump will abide by a Supreme Court ruling?
But Trump says a lot of things, but Trump himself said that, of course, he would apply by these district court rulings and he would appeal them. He said that mm-hmm. in the Oval Office. Now, Trump says a lot of things, so who knows what that means. Much more importantly, the Solicitor General of the United States, which is the component of the Justice Department that argues before the Supreme Court, in a recent emergency filing, went out of her way to say that, of course, the executive branch has a duty to comply with the decisions of the Supreme Court. A really robust statement of judicial supremacy. And so that was the most significant statement, I think.
And that is Trump's appointed Solicitor General?
It was Trump's appointed Solicitor General. And I would be surprised if she didn't say that without White House approval.
Uh-huh. So I guess that's encouraging. Those are a lot of places we could go. Well, for starters, is there a case where you think he has pretty clearly broken the law? And so ultimately there will be a ruling that what he did is illegal?
So it's too early to tell, but I'll tell you what I think. So the clearest to me that he's done things that are gradations of illegality or possible illegality. To me, at the mm-hmm. top of the list is maybe the least sexy thing, is the TikTok ban. This was Congress basically banned TikTok from mm-hmm. the states. The Supreme Court upheld the decision. This was all settled before Trump became president. The ban went into effect the day before he became president. He comes into office and says, I'm not going to enforce the ban because I don't like it, basically. I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically what he said. And he said that, and he ordered his attorney general to tell the private firms who were bound by this ban, don't worry about it. You can keep violating the law because we're not going to enforce it against you. And it won't be deemed a violation. Mm-hmm. This is a really blatant refusal to take law to enforce the law, which the president has a duty to do. Presidents have enforcement discretion in a variety of contexts, but one thing they can't do is just to decide they're not going to enforce the law because they don't like it. Now, so that's the clearest, to me, example of an illegal action. It's also a huge threat, obviously, to congressional power, because if Congress can pass laws and the president just decides he's not going to enforce them willy-nilly, that is a major shift of power from Article 1 to Article 2. The problem in this case is that there's no lawsuit. It's not clear who has standing to sue, so it's not clear it'll ever be challenged. But I would put that at the top of the list. And that happens a lot in constitutional law. That happens a lot that presidents and executive branches do things that are arguably illegal, but there's no plaintiff who can bring the lawsuit. That may seem weird to a non-lawyer, but it happens a lot.
Mm. I mean, somebody could make a claim that they're damaged by this, right? Somebody could say, I guess I'm a citizen in the U.S. and I fear that TikTok is a threat to the Republic, right?
But that doesn't count.
No. Okay. Well, this issue, this broad issue, the president's obligation to execute laws that Congress passes, you know, gets into the realm of spending that yep. Congress has authorized or mandated.
And that's my list. Yeah.
Okay. So that's, I don't know if in kind of, you know, legal philosophy, these are the, or constitutional theory, these are kind of the same issue. In other words, the TikTok issue and all of these cases where Trump might like to withhold funds or maybe has withheld funds, or Elon Musk is trying to find ways for the government to not spend money it had been spending under congressional authorization or whatever. But what is your take on that? I mean, first of all, what exactly has happened? I mean, in that, are there major quantities of funding that Trump is refusing to spend?
Yes. Yes. So this is a little complicated. Yes, there are major categories of funding that they are trying not to spend in various agencies. And there are some lawsuits and they're fighting about the meaning of the lawsuits that have tried to enjoin them to keep spending. And the problem is that it's not clear at this point why they're not spending. So it's hard to assess the legality of what they're doing. I'll get to the bigger picture issue, which is very important, in 1 second. It's very hard to know exactly what's going on in terms of what their legal justification is to not spend. There are so-called programmatic reasons why OMB cannot spend money in certain circumstances, especially in the transition to a new administration. There are complicated rules about under the Empowerment Control Act. So let me just say, it's not clear what their legal argument is for not spending. So we don't know how bad it is in terms of illegality. But let me just say that I do believe at the they have clearly articulated, both senior people in the administration and the president have clearly articulated the view that, setting aside these nitpicky little statutory arguments I've been talking about, that that's kind of all, and this congressional restriction that requires the president to spend, they've articulated the view that they don't have to follow it, that they can, that they have a constitutional power just not to spend however they want. Mm-hmm. And that's a cousin of the TikTok argument, but it's not the same thing, and it's worse. Because the TikTok argument, they're not enforcing a statute. In this context, if they assert that constitutional argument, they would be disregarding and ignoring a congressional requirement to spend the money. Mm-hmm. And if they do that, that's another extremely weak argument, and in my judgment, would be clearly unlawful. So that's the second thing on my list.
Okay, and this is the case where, I guess, Congress beefed up the law against impoundment in the wake of the Nixon experience, is that right?
Correct. Yes. Nixon had asserted a power of constitutional impoundment where he said he had the constitutional power, basically discretion not to enforce the law. It's an kind of an example of what you're talking about. Congress appropriates, the appropriation is law, Congress says spend the money, and Nixon said, I have the discretion not to. His head of the Office of Legal Counsel, a man named William Rehnquist, who went on to be the Chief Justice, wrote an opinion saying that Nixon was wrong, and Nixon ignored him. Rehnquist said it was illegal. Nixon ignored him, but it was the 70s and after Watergate, and Congress was in a period of exercising its responsibilities, and it passed a very important statute that said the president, with some conditions and loopholes and things, has to enforce money that's appropriated. So that's the law now. And so what Trump is trying to do is to assert a constitutional power a la Nixon, but the big difference is that Congress has now said you can't do it.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Elon Musk role in this is fascinating. My guess is that, so far as the law goes, it's almost a distraction. In other words, everything Elon Musk has done, if there are cases where he sent some email that technically Trump should have sent, right? Or something, Trump could do that. I mean, Trump's allowed to consult people. I guess what I mean is, everything Elon Musk is doing, there would be a way for Trump to do without the so-called Elon Musk issue entering into it. Does that make sense?
I think that's right. I mean, I think, again, I'm sorry to keep saying this, and I've been trying to study this. It's very hard to know exactly what's going on. And in fact, we're still very early in this. All this stuff will be fleshed out. But in fact, a couple of the cases against Musk have been dismissed simply because the judges, who are very sensible, fine judges, say, you've just shown me news reports. You haven't shown me facts about what's going on. I need to know more about what's going on before I can rule here. So we're still not figuring this out. Your basic point is right. Musk does not appear to have any independent authority to order anything. Basically, he is what's called a special governmental employee who's kind of associated in the White House. And he has this free-roaming dispensation to influence people who are going into these agencies and trying to learn things. But basically, nothing coercive can happen, apparently, without the president or the White House or some official with authority ordering it.
Mm-hmm.
So now that doesn't mean he's not, that bad things aren't happening. I think this may be the strongest argument, to the extent that they're breaking into or getting access to privacy records, there's serious privacy law issues that come up. But I mean, you know, the president has basically, the original order on this was that four government employees would form teams and go into these agencies. And the president has the authority to send government employees, broadly defined, to go into agencies and do things. And it's not clear, and the arguments against Musk thus far have been pretty weak, actually.
Yeah, and I gather that, so this, the latest, and to my mind, maybe the most outrageous thing he's done, certainly one of them, the latest controversy, where he sends emails to God knows how many employees and says, list five things you've done last week. And then, and here's, this is such typical Musk, the email itself didn't say failure to respond will be taken as a resignation, but he did say that on Twitter, right? Like, now I would personally, if it's me and I'm doing this, I'd want to be pretty damn clear and explicit in the email itself. I wouldn't do this in the first place, but if I did, I would be that careful. As it just seems to me, I mean, this is a tangent, but it just seems to me such an illustration of the wanton carelessness and just disregard for normal rules of decency about your treatment of people, that you would say this thing, turn it into this threat that could wind up depriving them of their jobs on Twitter, but not put that in the email and figure, oh, and just think, oh, let them figure it out. You see, it looks like you want to say something before I get to the actual question. So go ahead.
No, can I just say two things about that? One, yeah. I don't know where, it's actually a good question, where he got the authority. Did he actually send the email himself?
I believe the emails came from the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget.
Yeah, that's different. So that means it's not coming from Musk, and that means it may be okay. But the second part, before you get to your question, talking about how rude it is and how disruptive it is and how discombobulating all this is, that's a feature, not a bug for these people.
Mm-hmm.
They love that. They're trying to disrupt, discredit, incapacitate these institutions. They're trying to scare people into either quitting or being compliant and carrying out their wishes. So what you're describing as this weird, disruptive, chaotic system, I think there's a method in the madness.
Well, I was going to ask that, because one theory you hear, a relatively benign interpretation of the long-term aims here is, well, they want these issues of executive power, many of which come under this idea of the unitary theory of the executive, which we'll get to be vetted by the Supreme Court, because there's this longstanding conservative aspiration for this doctrine of the unitary executive to get the forceful support of the Supreme Court. So they just want to get this in front of the Supreme Court. Well, look, there's other ways to get this in front of the Supreme Court, where you don't terrify literally millions of federal employees and don't do various other things that I agree with you are done for some other purpose.
But they're trying to do both, Bob. I mean, in fact, I think these are at cross purposes in a way different than what you just said. Yes, they could have brought all of these test cases to test the scope of the president's unitary executive authority vis-a-vis the executive branch. We'll talk about that. It's mostly about removal power, but it's about other things. There's a quite orderly, logical calm, methodical, and probably much more successful in the end way they could have done this. Instead, they're doing both at the same time. They're trying to bring the, they're exercising these broad unitary executive authorities, which is basically the idea that the president gets to control the executive branch, period. We can talk about it in more detail later. They're trying to implement extreme versions of these theories because they believe in them and they want to assert those powers, and they also want the Supreme Court to bless them. My view is that the chaotic, vicious, haphazard, disruptive, irresponsible way in which this power is being exercised is going to give some of the justices pause. I mean, it really is a Frankenstein monster of the unitary executive that we're seeing. And so it's going to be very interesting if the unitary executive justices confronted with the Frankenstein version are going to think it's a good idea.
Yeah, no, he is asking for a more expansive, for the Supreme Court to affirm a more expansive conception of presidential power while illustrating the perils of doing that.
Precisely. So, exactly. And it's, I don't know if they're, I really don't know if this is by design, this is by accident. I can't tell if there's a plan. It seems to me that those are at cross purposes. But I will tell you, there are a lot of justices on the court that want to implement this view in certain respects. So it's a really interesting question whether justices who have had a kind of lifelong vision of how the executive branch should work, and now they kind of have the opportunity because the cases are coming their way, are going to blanch because it's being applied in a way that doesn't seem terribly attractive.
Right. So you got into this, the whole history of this argument about the unitary executive in your Economist piece, and it really is interesting, and I want you to talk about it because it kind of starts with a New Deal, and you might think that conservatives would be, and they were, I think, immediately, during the Roosevelt administration, immediately thereafter, very suspicious of a powerful presidency because they thought Roosevelt had exceeded his powers. But then explain how it comes to be that that conservatives wind up wanting a stronger president. It's almost a stronger president if not a stronger presidency.
So, yes, so the New Deal gets going. The New Deal dramatically reorients American constitutional law. And by the way, just as a side note, the Trump people are using as a model the New Deal in reverse. They look at FDR, they see he was there, he was aggressive, he changed things on the ground, he eventually coerced the Supreme Court or influenced them into coming around. And they see themselves, many of them see themselves as doing an FDR in reverse. So that's the first point. But for the first 20, 30, 40 years, especially when Robert Taft was leading the party, and I'm simplifying here, the conservatives were very much against, conservative Republicans, the majority conservative Republican was very much against the broad power given to these administrative agencies. They didn't really fit into the constitutional scheme. They're a headless fourth branch. They don't like the regulations they're doing. They're anti-capitalist. So they just didn't like it. And this was a period in which conservatives were worried about too much presidential power. And it's surprising now, but for the middle of the last century, that was the conservative position, is that we need to worry about the executive branch and the presidency. This was a problem because at the same time, they wanted a powerful presidency to deal with the Cold War, but that's a different story. In the domestic realm, they were against presidential power. And basically, to make a long story short, by the 1970s, it had become apparent that the president and the bureaucracy were two different things. And that the bureaucracy was this monster kind of growing out of control in the conservative mind due to Congress giving it all these powers and courts empowering them. And the idea was, and Jeffrey Hart had this famous quote in the National Review in the 1970s, is that basically what you really needed was a super powerful presidency who could go to war with his own bureaucracy. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that was a very important idea. And that was the idea that came into being during the Reagan administration. It got going a little bit under Nixon, but it really came into being in the Reagan administration. And you want me to just keep going and explain the unitary executive?
Yeah.
So, and this is when this idea during the Reagan administration of the unitary executive got going. And the idea is, and this is an idea that had echoes throughout American history, going back to the founding. There were some famous Supreme Court cases. There was a famous dispute at the founding. But basically, this is a new name that's packaging this idea in a way it's never been packaged before. And the basic idea was, Constitution says in Article 2 that the executive power is vested in the president, period. It's the only of the three branches that is vested in one person. As the Supreme Court said in Trump versus United States, the president is a branch of government. And that idea is a simple idea. Everything follows from that. The president is the executive branch. The president has the executive power. The president has the duty to take care to faithfully execute the law. And that basically means that in carrying out his executive functions, he has to control everyone in the executive branch. He has to be able to direct them. He has to be able to manage them. He has to be able to fire them. And that Congress cannot interfere with that. And you can see why that theory is going to be very helpful if you're trying to bring the bureaucracy under control. Because basically it says the president can bring the bureaucracy under control through firing and orders and directions and the like. And Reagan applied this theory in what seemed like kind of a controversial way at the time, but from our current perspective, it was pretty tame. He imposed cost-benefit analysis on the agencies, and he expanded OMB's power, and he deregulated in a traditional way. But he wasn't doing the stuff Trump's doing. And there were people in the executive branch then that wanted to go all the way, and it just never happened. Okay. And George W. Bush, same kind of muddled thing. He probably wasn't even as devoted to it as Reagan was, nor was his father. So that's the theory. And you want to take it up to the Trump people now? Or do you
have— I would like to ask, when you said it seems tame by comparison to Trump. So what's a good example of something that Trump has done? I mean, you've listed several that I'm sure qualify, but something just clearly Reagan wasn't close to doing that Trump has now done.
Very simple. There were people in the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department where I used to work. This is the branch of the division in the Justice Department that does legal rulings for the executive branch, presumptively. There were people in the Justice Department who were true Unitarians who believed that independent agencies where Congress has given the members of the agencies for-cause protections that raise the hurdles to the president firing them, that they were unconstitutional, and that there can't be an independent agency in the unitary executive. And a lot of people in the Reagan administration believe that, but the Reagan administration never lifted a finger to implement that. Mm-hmm. No Republican administration has done that. And Trump now is going all in. He's firing all sorts of independent agencies. The Office of Special Counsel is an independent agency, has for-cause protections. He was fired. The member of the NLRB was fired. So that's a clear example. And this is a big deal in American constitutional law, that a president is finally asserting the authority to fire, in the face of a congressional prohibition, members of independent agencies.
There is an explicit congressional prohibition on firing these very people. So this isn't just norm violation.
It's not a prohibition. It's a condition. There's limit. You can only do it for cause. I can't remember the exact phrase.
So he didn't even go through the ritual. I mean, for cause is a pretty big loophole, but he didn't even go through the ritual of seeming to comply with articulating the cause, right?
Correct. He said, I don't have to. He said that statute, under my theory of Article 2, is unconstitutional. And he just blew through it.
That's pretty aggressive.
Yes and no. I would say it's not as aggressive as the other things, as the impoundment point, mm-hmm. or the TikTok point. And the reason is the Supreme Court has been moving in this direction. And there's a basis in Supreme Court. And the court hasn't gone this far yet, but there's definitely a base that's going in this direction. And there's a basis in the Supreme Court cases for this.
But it is a clear violation of the law as it stands and is clearly written, right? I mean, The law's there on the books. It says he's got to do this before he fires somebody. He doesn't do this. He does fire them. That seems like a clear violation of the law. What is the law?
Sorry, it's more complicated.
Good luck. Good luck convincing me, but go ahead. Try.
I don't think it's hard to understand. You might not agree with the premise. There are two laws here. There's the congressional statute, and then there's the Constitution. And if the Constitution says that the president can fire and the Congress can't limit his ability to fire, then the law is that the president can fire and the congressional statute is unconstitutional.
Okay, but the Constitution's, quote, articulation of that is in fact depends on some kind of interpretation, right?
Yeah, and the president gets to interpret the law for the executive branch. This happens all the time. This is an important point. President, Obama did this, Biden did this. Presidents interpret laws to allow them to do things. Sometimes they stretch the law. Sometimes they anticipate Supreme Court decisions. This basic move is not a crazy move, especially in this removal context. It's not a crazy move. And unlike the TikTok and impoundment things and the birthright citizenship things, those things don't have a leg to stand on, in my view. This one has a leg to stand on. It has a basis in the Supreme Court cases. And so it's not as bad as those cases, those other cases. Okay.
But let me say, if I were arguing for the Supreme Court, I would pull out what may be a novel argument. I don't know. It's this. It's like everyone agrees that the idea of the Constitution, among others, is to have a balance of power among these three branches, right? Now, in a certain sense, and I understand that in a commonsensical way, it seems to make sense that, it's the executive branch. What do we expect CEOs to do? The chief executives execute, and they can and they can do pretty much whatever they want in a corporation. But the thing about the executive branch is it's, in a certain sense, the only branch that has agency, right? It does things. It moves people and material and decides who which countries get bombed and it does things. It has agency. Okay. So what's that?
Hamilton said it had the sword.
Yeah. Well, the sword abroad, but I'm not just talking about that. I'm saying it within the bounds of our country, it is the one that actually does stuff. So if you say, the one branch that has agency cannot be constrained by the congressional branch, even if it tries to spell out what the branch with agency can do, well, there can't be a balance of power between those two because Congress can't actually do anything by itself.
I didn't say Congress could not constrain the president.
Well, we just said there's this written law. No, but the theory that because the Constitution, by some reading, which sounds to me not necessarily more far-fetched than the reading that conservatives complained about in the case of Roe versus Wade, but leave that aside. I don't know what I'm talking about. I admit I'm not a constitutional lawyer. But in both cases, just as Roe versus Wade found this thing about privacy in the Constitution, even though the word's not there, it sounds to me like this unitary theory is finding something in the Constitution that is not explicit, and if you accept that interpretation, then you're saying that even though in this case, to get back to this example, where Congress says you cannot fire this person unless you at least submit this written statement first, and Trump doesn't do that, well, if we're saying the president can decide he can ignore that, I don't know.
Can I make a couple of, I have two or three points to make here to try to relieve.
Calm me down.
Your anxiety, yes. What if Congress passed a law that said there shall be two presidents? Would the president have to comply with that?
No, that would clearly violate written parts of the Constitution.
So you agree that if Congress passed a statute and said there have to be two presidents, the president could say that's not constitutional and he could ignore it?
No, I think he should somehow get it to the Supreme Court.
How can he get it to the Supreme Court if he doesn't ignore it?
As you know, I have an expansive conception of standing, Jack.
Yeah, but the Supreme Court doesn't.
Remember my TikTok example?
Yes, but the Supreme Court doesn't. This is the point. I mean, if you don't allow, if the president off, in this case, in the removal case, like I don't want to defend this too much, but in the removal context, let's go back to my example first. Congress can do all sorts of crazy things that are unconstitutional. And if the president can't challenge them through his own constitutional interpretation that this is invalid, and then it's often mm-hmm. subject to judicial review, then the president just has to sit there and take all these unconstitutional statutes Congressman imposed.
Well, okay. So in response to your question, the way he gets to the Supreme Court is he says, no, I'm not going to do it. And then somebody sues him, right? And it gets to the Supreme Court.
And that's exactly what's happening with removal. Exactly.
Okay, fine. I'm not arguing that this isn't a good way for him to get something to the Supreme Court. I'm arguing that if the Supreme Court supports him and says you can fire this person without doing what Congress said you have to do to fire them, that's a crazy ruling.
Why?
Because
this happens all the time.
The only actual constraint Congress has on the president is to pass these laws that say things. Now, granted, if they violate the Constitution, that's one thing. But what, in effect, it seems to me these people are arguing is that any constraint on the president violates the Constitution because he gets to decide what happens in the executive branch.
I'm not saying that. And as of yet, the Trump people haven't said that. We started on let's go back to our discrete example because we talked about the removal power. Congress has placed for-cause removal restrictions on certain people in the executive branch. In the last 10 years, the Supreme Court has invalidated three of these. The Supreme Court has said that in three different contexts, these congressional removal restrictions are unconstitutional. Congress does not have the power to do that. It violates Article 2 of the Constitution, which gives the executive power to the president. These are robust rulings by the Supreme Court. People disagree with them. Some people think they're right. Some people think they're wrong. But that's what the Supreme Court has said. And that is what the Trump people are relying on in doing these firings. And then they're going to be subject to judicial review. And the Supreme Court in the end is going to decide. And that's the way it works, I'm afraid. And if you don't allow, and again, I don't want to overstate this, but if you don't allow the president to exercise his own constitutional judgment, and if Congress can pass unconstitutional laws that make the president do things that it doesn't have power to do, then the executive branch is going to be stuck with all these unconstitutional laws. The only way it can challenge them, or almost usually the only way it can challenge them, is by defying them. And then it gets worked out in court most of the time.
Yeah, well, I don't deny the Supreme Court has made these rulings. I'm sure they have. I'm just saying, although I'd have to look at them individually, I doubt the overarching philosophy under which they're made. Is there an example of what one of the things they've said Congress definitely can't do, a constraint on hiring or firing the Congress that they prohibited?
I'm sorry, say that again.
These three Supreme Court cases you mentioned, what kinds of things were they saying Congress can't do specifically?
One of them was that basically that Congress cannot put two levels of removal restrictions. They can't put a for-cause restriction on someone and then put on some subordinate, some superior over an inferior has a for-cause restriction. And then there's below that person, another one with a for-cause restriction. That's a double for-cause restriction. And basically the court said that violates the president's power to control the executive branch. But I think the bottom line problem here is you don't think the president should have a robust, you're not agreeing with the unitary executive theory. You don't think the president should have the authority to remove subordinates.
I wouldn't say that. No, I would say if Congress says he doesn't have the power, I don't know if I want to finish this sentence this way, but the furthest I go certainly is to say if Congress says he doesn't have the power, he doesn't have the power. But I'm certainly not saying that just you could read the Constitution and conclude that the president can't fire people. No, quite the opposite. I would assume he can fire whoever he wants unless constrained by legislation.
But there are limits on what Congress can do in terms of constraint.
According to this unitary theory, I get that.
Yeah, but this unitary theory that we talked about that came up in the 80s, This idea about the president's power to fire, there's a lot of dispute about this. It goes back to 1793. And the main Supreme Court case was in the 20s or 30s. So This is not a new idea. And it's been back and forth and being worked out by the courts for literally, you know, over 100 years. This is not a crazy idea. This is the least, maybe the least crazy idea of what the Trump people have been doing. I'll just say, just to move it off in a little bit different direction, it's harder, and Trump is on weaker ground in firing people with civil service protections.
Okay. Yeah.
I feel like I'm not being clear here.
Well, no, the problem is my ignorance. I don't know anything about this stuff. I have a remarkable air of confidence about my opinions for someone who has no idea what they're talking about. But I've been watching Trump, and that seems to work, right? Like, you just say shit and people believe it, you know?
Look, listen. Let me just say one more thing about this. The idea of removing certain officials, especially officials in independent agencies, is a very longstanding fight that's been going on in the academy and in the courts and across Supreme Courts for a long time. The Supreme Court has been moving in the direction of giving the president much more power. They have a plausible basis to do this. I mean, I think, you know, it's one of these arguments where you can argue both sides. They have a plausible basis to do this. And the court is kind of committed to this. So Trump is acting here based on a prediction of what the Supreme Court's going to do. And he's got some decent case law in his support. And he might win. So in the general scheme of things of what he's doing, even though he's being disruptive and difficult and sloppy, he has a decent legal argument here.
Yeah. I mean, my overarching point is that when you think about the fact that only executive branch can do stuff, can really make things happen. If you really want a balance of power, you're going to have to give a certain amount of deference to the laws that Congress passes that may have a constraining effect on the president. But,
you know, just think you need, again, I'm just saying the same thing. You need to look at the other side of that. Do you think Congress spends a lot of time caring about the constitutionality of its statutes? Answer, no.
No.
They don't. They pass all sorts of statutes all the time that burden the executive branch in a way that is inconsistent with Supreme Court jurisprudence. Happens all the time. This is what OLC spends a lot of time ferreting out. And if the president has to just take it, which seems to be your view, and just has to accept these unconstitutional restrictions, then that is not a balance of power either.
Yeah, I don't. I'm not saying that he has to accept anything unconstitutional, but I'm arguing about what is and isn't unconstitutional. Again, I don't know. I'm just making a more generic point that only occurred to me in this context, thinking about this like the last couple of days, like. The executive branch is a branch that does stuff, so we shouldn't let it get too carried away with what it.
May I make a distinction? There's a very important distinction here. Sometimes when the president, it's called disregards a congressional statute, like he's done in the removal context. I worry about that not very much when it can go to court and be reviewed in court.
Right.
It's not going to be the president getting the last word. And that's what's going to happen in all these removal cases. And frankly, that's the way it works. That's the way it worked with Biden's student loan cases. That's the way it worked with Obama's immigration deferral programs. That's the way it works. That's the way it works, basically. Presidents do things that might be unconstitutional and either sometimes enforcing federal statutes, sometimes ignoring federal statutes, and the court gets to decide. That is a relatively unworrisome situation. There are a lot of situations where the president ignores, and this is much more worrisome, where the president, your point has more force, where the president disregards a federal statute and it's not something that's subject to judicial review. And there, just the president wins and Congress loses, and there's a huge asymmetry there. And I agree with you on that.
It's not subject just because nobody has standing to sue, or what?
Nobody has standing to sue. There are a whole bunch of judicial doctrines. It might be a political question. No one might have a cause of action to sue.
Are there things he's doing right now that fall in this category that worry you?
Well, the TikTok ban is a perfect example, but most of the other things, most of the other things, I'm having a hard time thinking of another example. It seems that there's a basis, although, you know, these lawsuits have been going off the skids because they haven't had enough evidence and all sorts of these preliminary issues. But basically, I think most of the things that Trump is doing will ultimately be subject to judicial review. The only one I'm sure of off the top of my head is the TikTok ban. That's worrisome because the president's basically blowing off a statute. Mm-hmm. But I think most of the stuff is going to be subject to judicial review.
Okay. Well, listen, as you know, what we do with these podcasts is we have a pretty big conversation that's publicly available. And we go into overtime. And that is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. There's a link you can click in the show notes of your podcast app. And then you can just set up a podcast feed that always has the overtime stuff. And you get some bonus written content and the satisfaction of knowing that you're supporting what I hope you consider a good cause. And Jack's been kind enough to stick around, I think, for a while. We may get pretty deep here. And there's a lot I want to talk about. One is I want to let you finish your story about the history of this unitary thing. That has now become a cliffhanger that I think will entice people into following us into overtime. Is there anything else you want to say kind of big picture-wise? Well, you know, it sounds like a lot of this will wind up in the Supreme Court. We have reason to think maybe Trump will abide by the Supreme Court rulings.
Yes, we have reason to think maybe that he'll abide by them. That's yeah. Correct.
And then there's a question. I do want to pursue this in overtime. How much of the our concern that should assuage? In other words, the question of how important norms are. The breaking of norms is for, you know, long-term health prospects of the republic. Is there anything else you want to say? I mean, again, I recommend your newsletter, Executive Functions, for precisely this, the kind of things we're talking about right now, coverage of this ongoing thing. Anything else you want to say?
Now or later?
No, now, by way of making sure nobody misunderstood something you said or self-promotion or whatever.
I think everything I said, I'll stand by at least until tomorrow when I figure out I made a mistake. I do think there's lots to discuss. We've been talking about, and maybe this is for the next half, we've been talking about things Trump did that might be illegal and whether they're subject to judicial review. There are two other big questions. One is, will he abide by court decisions? And another one is, a lot of what he's doing is not illegal. It's just blowing through norms in a kind of, and basically just reorienting the way the government works and the expectations of executive behavior in a way that hard to know what it looks like on the other end.
That's one of the main things I want to talk about. Okay, so thanks to everybody who's followed us this far. Hope you follow us into overtime. And Jack, thank you for sticking around. And now we will go into overtime.